is coming from the Orphan Male Girls Division. Did you know there's an Orphan Male Girls Division?
Yes. I picked two of them up the other day.
Oh. Okay.
I've only known it.
Yes, it's in the basement of a house in an undisclosed location.
I know where it is.
There are no secrets from Josh.
None whatsoever.
Okay, so tonight is history night. We were speaking about the past couple of times about the 16th century and the composition of the Shulchan Aruch. And we spoke about the Beis Yosef, the Ramah, we also mentioned the Bach, there was a commentary more on the tour. Now I want to talk about the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. I don't know if there don't have a Shulchan Aruch in this room. Does anybody know where to find a Shulchan Aruch in the Beis Medrash?
No.
Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. That was easy enough. So the Shulchan Aruch looks very much like a Gemara. In that sense, it has a middle text, and it has commentaries on the sides, and commentaries on the bottom. Now this one we have to pick out is Choshen Mishpat. There are four sections of the Shulchan Aruch. There's Orach Chaim, which is on day-to-day laws. Yoredeh, which is on Kashrus, Nida, a bunch of other, Avelus, a lot of stuff which is not day-to-day. And then there is Choshen Mishpat on monetary law, and Ebn Ezer on laws having to do with women's issues, such as marriage and divorce and so on and so forth. Yeah?
The rabbis are tested on the Talmud.
All rabbis have to know. The minimum you have to know is 80 of these pages.
Really?
Not so hard to be a rabbi. No. It's a joke. So, we make
the level, I mean, you're
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's
like
this level is the same,
yeah?
The basic
Yore.
Basic level, not the fake smicha, which is Rav Manhig, not the Dionys smicha, which is Yadin Yadin, regular basic smicha, Yore.
That's about 80 pages, that's
80 pages.
80 pages?
80 pages.
So there's one even lower than that?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, the one they give teachers when they need to call themselves rabbi.
Wait, what do you need to know that?
Whatever. There's no standards for that. You need to get a piece of paper.
You think you tested English?
It depends who decides, you know, depends who gives it to you. I personally sell them. There's no standard for that. There is no quality control on rabbis, you know that, right? There's no quality control on rabbis. The fact that something's called rabbi is meaningless, right? Everybody know that? Okay, good.
You're talking to rabbis, they
don't take some tests, takes a couple hours. Yeah, but like in some yeshivas, they give a test each week on what they learned during the week before.
Right.
So that quiz counts, you know.
So what is the Shema Yisrael thing then?
The Shema Yisrael thing is a very comprehensive program, more comprehensive than the minimum.
Okay.
You know, so if you want the minimum, then you don't have to go through the Shema Yisrael thing.
Okay.
In any event, that's why that might doesn't matter. Okay, moving right along. So in the middle, you have the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. The Shulchan Aruch and the block print, that's the Beis Yosef, the Mechaber. The Sephardic halacha, the source of Sephardic halacha, and then you have in the Rashi print, you know Rashi print has nothing to do with Rashi, right? Everybody knows that? Right?
What?
Rashi print has nothing to do with Rashi.
Who?
Rashi never saw Rashi print.
Who came up with
that? The publishers. Publishers, yeah. So it's called Rashi print because Rashi always gets printed in those letters, but it's nothing to do with Rashi itself. It's an interesting point to make, which is there is an author, Rabbi Menashe Klein, who writes that the reason Rashi print came about is if you print something in real Hebrew letters, you're implying that it has a certain level of holiness. If you want to show that, you know, that you don't know if this stuff is really holy, if it's real, so then you print it in Rashi letters. So it became customary to print most Sfarim of later sources in Rashi prints to indicate that we're not sure if they're as holy as the real stuff, which is the earlier sources. So But in any event, that's, I don't think there's any. Here, I just think it's a way of distinguishing between who's who. And here, in Chosh Mishpat, you have the Me'iras Einayim, which is also called the Sma, because that's Sefer Me'iras Einayim, Samech Mem Ayin, is the Sma. As a matter of fact, he's always called the Sma. He's never called Me'iras Einayim. If you go to any Yeshiva Baruch Adam, well, the Me'iras Einayim says, well, look at you as you just fell out of the moon. So you have to go and talk about the Sma. Otherwise, you won't understand what you're saying. And he's the very basic commentary. It's kind of like the Rashi. He has inside the page, like Rashi is. He's kind of like the Rashi, I'm sure. And on the outside of the page, you have the Shach. The Shach is called the Sifrei Kohen, but again, nobody will know what the Sifrei Kohen is. So you have to say the Shach. So the Shach is the more intricate commentary, more abstract. It's like the Tosfos on Chosin Mishpat. Now, both of these commentaries authors lived in the early 1600s. And generally, when you see commentaries in Shulchan Aruch, the major commentaries were written in the early 1600s to mid-1600s. Later commentaries are usually on the bottom, and they're not as authoritative as the commentaries on the top. Now, you have a similar scheme in all of the four volumes of Shulchan Aruch, but the commentaries change. For example, in Orach Chaim, the one on the inside, not sure if it's inside or outside, but I think the inside is the Magen Avraham, and the outside is the Taz. The Magen Avraham is called the Magen Avraham. The Taz, his official name is Surei Zohar. He's called the Taz for short. The Taz is older than the Magen Avraham. The Taz tried to prevent the Magen Avraham from commentary from being printed. The Taz was punished from God. Now, we almost always pass them like the Magen Avraham over the Taz. Okay? That's one of those nice tidbits of Jewish history that's worthwhile remembering. So when I say Paskin, it means if you look at in later sources, such as the Mishnah Berurah or HaShulchan, which has to determine who's right, a difference between Magen Avraham and the Taz, they're usually passing like the Magen Avraham over the Taz. So the Taz is a more verbose commentary. He just uses a lot of more words. The Magen Avraham is extremely terse. And therefore, there are many commentaries written on the Magen Avraham, also commentaries written on the Taz, but more on the Magen Avraham than on the Taz, because since it was so short and terse, people have to elaborate on what he said. That's in Orach Chaim. In Evin Ezer, the two commentaries are the Chalkas Mechokek on the inside and Beis Shmuel on the outside. Again, the same kind of Rashi types of similarity. And in Yoredeya, it's the Shach and the Taz. So the Taz, who was primary in, one of the primary two in Orach Chaim, also is in Yoredeya. The Shach is one of the primary two in Chosin Mishpat, is in also in Yoredeya. Now the Shach and Taz were contemporaries, and they went back and forth at each other. So the commentary was written first. The commentary which was written first was the Surei Zohar, right? That's the Taz. The commentary written after that is the Sifrei Kohen, the Shach. Okay? So now this is the Taz, the Shach. So then the Shach attacks the Taz very often because it's written slightly later. The Taz came back and wrote a commentary attacking the Shach. And that commentary is not it's called the Shudos HaKesef. Now, I wrote that here so you can see that it's a play on words, right? Turei Zohar, rose of gold, the Shudos HaKesef, points of silver, right? And also the Sifrei Kohen, all these have to do with what the Kohen wore on his breastplate, right? The Choshen Mishpat, because it is the area of Shulchan Aruch. Choshen Mishpat is on what they're written. The Choshen was the breastplate, so it had rows of gold, and it was worn by the Kohen, and that really doesn't fit in, but I guess it was a cute name to give it, so that's why he gives it that name. And that's that's the Yoredeya. In Chosin Mishpat, you have a similar thing, but not between the Sma and the Shach, with basic commentaries, but much later, in the 19th century. And the 19th century commentaries, which are on the page, in the which are major in the Chayshim Mishpat, are the Ktosa Choshen, again Choshen, and the Siva HaMishpat. And they are the basic building blocks of yeshiva learning. There's a famous joke, it's not so big a joke, is how does yeshiva bachur know that it's forbidden to steal? Because it says so in the Ktos. So the Ktos is the Ktos HaChoshen, and he's one of the major achronim, and Yeshiva Shalom, this 101, begins with the Ktos. So those are the two later commentaries which are important to in yeshivas. Now, since they're important in yeshivas, you should realize that they're not so much halachic as lomdish, right? They talk about the abstract ideas behind law as opposed to actually ruling. And the Sivas has two parts in this commentary. There's a short commentary which actually has laws and a long commentary which has the abstract ideas. The Sivas is almost always abstract. So they also went at it in the same way as the Shach and the Taz. Then the Sivas attacks the Sivas. The Ktos responded in a sefer called Mishovei Nesivos. Mishovei Nesivos means he who disrupts the pathways. Okay, this is the pathways of judgment. He who disrupts the pathways. And the Nesivos came out in two editions. And the edition which spent the Shulchan Aruch is a later edition in which he attacks the Mishovei Nesivos. So they're actually going back and forth, and they went on good personal terms. So they actually go back and forth and dialogue about different aspects in Shulchan Aruch and Chayshim Mishpat. And this is, of course, much of what yeshiva learning consists of, is understanding what the Ktos and the Sivas are arguing about. So, for example, the Ktos and the Sivas will argue on what is Yesh. When it says in Bar Metzia that an object is considered to be definitively lost when a person is misyayish from it. He gives up hope and says, Vay lechetron kif, woe to this loss which I had from my pocket. So what is yayish? Is it a form of hefker or is it not a form of hefker? Meaning, when I am misyayish from something, is my ownership then terminated immediately, as would be if I made something hefker, I relinquished ownership on it, or is it meaning that it's still mine, but somebody who comes and picks it up now will not transgress the prohibition of stealing? Because it's as if I gave permission to anybody to come to pick it up who wants to come and pick it up. You got the difference between those two approaches?
Not sure.
What? There might not be any nafkamina. No, I have to be a lot of nafkamina. But there are a lot of nafkamina. Because the question is, can you actually be mitzvah from something which is still in your backyard? So if you hold this hefker, you can't become hefker in your backyard. But if you hold it yeish from something else, it may well work in something. Also, what happens if you meet yeish from an object? The case more gives a baba kama, a hen which rebelled, panigola shemorda. You have a rebellious hen, and the rebellious hen ran out, you know, and you gave up hope of ever getting the rebellious. It's a tough hen, so you gave up hope of ever getting it back. So you're meet yeish. So now it comes back. Do you still own it, or can anybody grab it? The case, another case which the Gemara could give there is, there was a case where there was a caravan going in the desert, and there was a lion following the caravan, and every day they had to feed a donkey to the lion, because otherwise the lion would start eating people. So the day of a certain Amora came, and his donkey was not eaten. So does he still retain ownership over it? It was a miracle. Does he still retain ownership? It takes it back, or there's already he gave up on it, and therefore anybody wants to grab it can grab it. So those are cases in which there are ramifications of their differences of opinion, which will make a difference. I'm just going to say a couple of famous stories, and one famous place and one famous Mesivas. When I say famous, it means something I know, and I hope that you don't. But these are indeed famous pieces. The most famous place is the place in Simon Lama Dalit, Sifkat and Dalit, where he has a machlokas, a difference of opinion between himself and the Mari Ben Lev, one of the early Achronim who lived in Turkey, as to what the nature of Hodas Baal Din is. There's a principle which says, Hodas Baal Din, Kamea Edim Dami. If somebody confesses, the person who is a litigant admits to something, so it's as if it's 100 witnesses. So if I come, you say, listen, you owe me $100, and I say, yes, I do owe you $100. So even though there are no witnesses on the fact that I borrowed the money, my confession, my admission in of itself is that it's tons of witnesses, and you can collect the money from me. So their question is, what is Hodos Baldin? Is Hodos Baldin a form of credibility? That a person has credibility vis-a-vis himself, and he can say, even though he can't testify unilaterally about somebody else, and even though himself he can't testify something which is positive, but a person does have credibility to say something negative about himself, or is it as a gift? In other words, we don't actually believe that he had some prior obligation to pay this guy $100, but now he made a statement, and that statement becomes as if he committed to give a gift of $100. So is it, though thus filed in, does it actually reflect some sort of reality which we assume it took place, or is it totally divorced from reality, and it just has to do with what he decides, the fact that he decided now to give this guy a gift? And there are implications of this, because we have the principle in Allah of Shavi Anafshi Chaticha Bisura. When you make something prohibited to yourself, you make it to yourself something prohibited, even though it's not necessarily prohibited to somebody else. But if I come to you and I say, this piece of meat, I am convinced that this piece of meat is trace. So I can't eat it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't eat it. If I testify it's not trace, then under certain conditions, one witness is believed, and therefore you might not be able to eat it. But if I just say, I believe it's trace, so for me it's awesome, but not for you. So the question is, how does that work? If that means, so it's more, it seems like the opinion that it is my own new invention as opposed to something which reflects reality. There are many discussions which emerge from that. The Nesivus, you guys getting this? Hey, but I'm a little bit sleepy, a little tired tonight. Am I that boring tonight?
What's the point of spending a whole year learning about this?
About what?
Guys in Kola, they sit there and they learn this. Why specifically this? I mean, is it to sharpen the mind? How is it, if you say the purpose of Torah mitzvah is to make you a better person, how is this making you a better person?
Well, the intellectual process in of itself, we assume, makes a person a better person, right? And generally speaking, when you get to the higher realms of any body of knowledge, so the more practical something is, the more disdain which scholars have for it. In other words, in mathematics, the highest form of study is pure mathematics. Mm-hmm. And pure mathematics means totally divorced from reality. Right? If you study literature, the highest form of literature is that literature which is completely weird. Right? Something which is very basic, it's a nice story, that's not really literature. Right? So in every body of knowledge, the more esoteric and abstract a concept, the more scholarly it is. And people, Torah scholars are scholars too. So they specialize in abstract knowledge.
How do you define character?
What?
How's it meet us? How are you working with meet
us? Well, it's not necessarily defining character directly, but we assume that the more expanded a mind is, and particularly if it's expanded in a holy way by Torah, the more higher functioning the person will become, even if there's no practical ramifications for what he's learning. This, by the way, I had a Rosh Hashiva once that when I was complaining to this Rosh Hashiva about my parents, they didn't want to let me stay in Israel and learn, they wanted me to come back to America and go to college. So he said to me, there's this big HR which parents have, which is this antipathy to Torah. He said, if you decided to go to your parents and say you want to become a professor of Finnish, of Finn literature, literature written in Finland, right? Or the Finnish language, so they would support you, gung-ho, right? That's real knowledge, right? But if you tell somebody you want to learn esoteric Torah, so then people say, well, what good is that? So, I'm not trying to attack you. I'm getting emotional. So this idea, because it's abstract and not practical, that's the way a lot of knowledge is like that. And people who are very smart are attracted to areas of knowledge which other people see as totally impractical and irrelevant. I mean, there are people who actually major in fin, basic people, but they do it. Yeah.
Does that then give the esoteric abstract knowledge precedence?
No. Because you have to go, just like in mathematics, you have to go first go through algebra. I don't know anything about math, by the way. I'm making this up as I go along. I mean, I managed to forget all mathematics I ever learned. That was a goal of mine in which I succeeded. So the you have to do algebra and trig before you get to calculus, right? So too, you have to go through the basics before you get to the esoteric. In yeshivas nowadays, that logical sequence is not always followed, because we have there's another issue, which is we gotta make it exciting and fun for people, and sometimes esoteric stuff is more fun. But theoretically, you have to build from the basics before you get to those more esoteric realms.
You used something like finished literature next to abstract Torah study. What about something theoretically more practical, like business or science?
What about it?
What would
science is applied physics and pure physics, isn't there?
Right.
So pure physics, not applied.
Right.
No application.
Right.
Right. What was the other one?
Business.
Yeah, I don't know. Business is. I don't know. Scholars regard business as being really scholarly. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What?
Not
yeah, not Columbus. Yeah.
I think the reason why a lot of people were actually really excited was because he had a lot of momentum in speaking.
What a what?
You just had a lot of momentum going over one of those.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, so what was the purpose in actually making the Shulchan Aruch, the structure, the page structure, like the Gemara?
I think because people, real Sfarim look like that, a real code. It became
so
the nature.
Make it
the Gemara came first. The non-Jewish publisher, Bromberg, in Italy, he made up the Tzura Sadaf, right, the shape of the page. And he set precedent that now, from now on, serious Jewish works, which have commentaries and super commentaries, they look this way.
I heard it's on Shino commentary.
What?
Sonsino.
No? No, they're much later. No. Sonsino was the place where the printing presses were, but they were owned by non-Jews.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Sonsino Press actually is in London, England.
So the reason they did was because it just looks
kashuf
like that?
Oh, I don't know why he did it. The first guy did
it. No, but it said this is not the Shulchan to make the Shulchan Aruch pattern like a Gemara.
Right.
It's nice. It's clean. It's clear.
What's the problem?
It seems like they're going out of their way to make it somewhat to add structure where none is needed. Intuitively, if the book would have been written like the Gemara, you'd put first the Gemara on the top, then the commentaries one after the other on the Gemara, going downwards, but not going through each other. That's not as I wouldn't think that that's an intuitive way to design the page.
You know, it's probably easier the way they set type in the old days to do it that way, the way they did it, because you have to figure out how much would go on a page. So if you did the commentaries in sync as you were setting the page of Gemara, so you could know how much commentary you could fit on the page with how much text, and everything would be synchronized as you go from top to bottom.
Okay.
Right. That might have been the reason why they did it. Obviously, it had something to do with the economy of printing.
And what's the purpose of continuing to use Rashi script? I mean, it doesn't.
Who says there is a purpose?
There's no purpose to begin with.
But it's cool. It becomes.
But why do things continue?
You know,
why do things have like?
Because every discipline has its own code, right? You write algebra a certain way, right? You write geometry a certain way, right? So this is the font for Torah thought.
It's not necessary.
I didn't say it was necessary. It's traditional.
What's holy about learning Gemara?
I've only been here some half. I think they failed with you, Ian. I think you got to leave.
I don't know. To me, it seems like we could look at it two ways. Like, one is this very holy thing. You know, there's a lot of Kedusha in the Gemara. And then on the flip side, the other half is that it's a very scholarly pursuit.
and it's, you know, just straight intellect, and we're arguing over these little nuances that's dismissed and abstract, and it's just like, well, okay, so to me, you know, when you bring it to that relative level, and I know it's not the Hobbesian, but you bring it to that relative level, it's like, okay, well, then the higher realms of mathematics, or, you know, your literary critics, whatever it may be, you know, arguing about these minute points, it's like, it's hard for me to see the Kedusha in that. You follow me in that way.
Why
is
there
a
Kedusha? Why is there a Kedusha? Why is there a Kedusha?
Because, to me,
Kedusha...
Let me
take a step back, waiter. You know, human beings have a quest for knowledge.
Right?
Now, people can use that knowledge, that quest for knowledge, at least men. It's a question whether women have the same quest for knowledge, from at least from our perspective, from Jewish perspective. So I would say nowadays they have more quest for knowledge, but once upon a time it was assumed that women had no quest for knowledge and men had a very powerful quest for knowledge. And you see that people do that. The remarkable place where you see this is in baseball statistics. The whole concept is totally absurd. But people spend their lives memorizing statistics and devising new statistics for this totally stupid, meaningless purpose. Right? Can you relate to what I'm saying?
Sure.
By the way, I'm very proud of myself. On
you're giving an example of that Rochelle Rubin power.
Right. But on Sunday, I was in... I had to take my kid to the hospital. He fell. Nothing. His head had walled when he was sweating. Nothing serious. And was sitting in the... I was sitting in the lobby, so there was a football game on. So, first time in a... Well, I don't know if I ever sat and actually watched a football game, but certainly not within the last 30 years. So it was such an interesting game, back and forth. The next day, you know, we talked about it in the Rabbein's room. So I said, you know, the Jets were playing the Patriots. Is either of these teams any good? So they said, my shoulder said to me, I think you're the only person in this building who did not know that the Patriots are the best team in football.
Mm-hmm.
Did everybody in this room know that?
No.
Okay, good.
Schiller,
not sure.
An
yeah, an MCA, yes. But I don't think Rabbi Schiller would comment on it that way. But so people use this quest for knowledge for all sorts of crazy things. So what we want, in Judaism, we try and take people's quests and channel them into holy pursuits. Now, it was never, as you know, and we've discussed many times, Judaism was never meant to be a religion in which everybody was a scholar, right? The current approach is a distortion, right? And it's a distortion which can be explained in many ways. But in theory, the masses were supposed to learn what was relevant to them. And today, let's say, the analog would be Daf Yomi, right? And then the scholars would learn more scholarly stuff, and more scholarly stuff, and more scholarly stuff, depending on who they were, right? And that way, it was elastic. Everybody had, to the extent that they quested knowledge, they would find a place in Torah, or an extent in Torah, to which to go. So, but that is addressing a basic human tendency, which is curiosity, and wonderment, and intellectual adventure. Why is that so hard for you to accept?
Okay, but really, I try to slip in, because I want to ask you a different question. This is like, my thing is that when you tell me, I don't know if you don't want to answer me, to wait till Wednesday. I don't understand Kedusha. And I could go with the designation of, I could go with the definition of designation, of designating something, and I see that line, say, for Torah, to fill in, but then we get to, like, for instance, I'm saying a bracha, and I'll stumble over a word. And, like, I don't know. Is there something holy about the bracha I'm making? Because to me, it's just like, I messed up, and I'm not at that madriga to, like, it's like, where it really, like, bothers me. Is there some kedusha in the bracha? Like, davening, it's like, you know, it's just like, you don't have so much kavana. Is there a lack of kedusha? I don't know what kedusha is necessarily, or how we apply it, or any of the sort. So when you say you're learning Gemara, and we boil it down to some, in a sense, of scholarly exercises directed toward a holy text, I don't, you know, I see the intellectual side, but where's the kedusha, and what is the kedusha? It's a very, I'm just confused of what kedusha is and the levels there are.
There's no one answer for what kedusha is. There are several levels of answer to that. The word kedusha in and of itself means devoted or designated. That's what it means. It can mean devoted for a holy cause or devoted for a profane cause. being designated for a holy cause, designated for a mundane or even improper cause. So it is the most fundamental essay on the topic of Kedusha written within the past 1,000 years is in the introduction by Reb Shimon Shkruf to his Sefer Shari Yosher. Shari Yosher is a classic Sefer on the style of the Ktos and the Sivas. Yeshiva Shalom, there's very little practical halacha, if any. And it's a fascinating Sefer because Reb Shimon always wanted to know the philosophical underpinnings of halacha, not just what the halacha is, but why the halacha is. And that's most of the Sefer. Shari Yosher. But the introduction to the Sefer is a short but beautiful masterpiece of Jewish thought. And he says, what is Kedusha? He speaks about this issue, what is Kedusha? And he says, well, Rashi says being in Parsha Kedusha means to separate yourself from licentious behavior, from improper relations. And the Ramban says there, famous Ramban says that Kedusha means that you are not a boor with the Torah's permission. You know, you don't, not a big drunkard, not a big fresser, not, don't have many wives, just live in moderation. Right? Yeah, some of you are gluttony. Okay? And so that's the Rashi and the Ramban. So Reb Shimon says, for various reasons he doesn't like that, most particularly because it says, Kedoshim ki ushbi holy, ki kadosh ani, because I am holy. And God, you know, God doesn't refrain from forbidden relationships or refrain from too much overeating because he's not physical. So therefore, this definition of kadosh will not refer to him. Right? So the Reb Shimon Shkruf says, that you're not, I'm not going to make you happier. I'm going to make you more miserable. Okay, is that okay?
It's fine.
Yeah. So for me, that's more than happy. The Shimon said that kedusha means devoted or designated, and when God created the world, He devoted or designated Himself to a specific single purpose. What's that specific single purpose?
To make sacrifice for suffering.
No.
Giving.
Say it again.
Giving.
Right. Lehati. To do good. So Rabbi Shimon says, to be kadosh means to be giving. Now, to be giving means that whatever you do, I mean, obviously there are levels, right? The greatest, most holy person, or the person who is going to be most concerned with and giving to humanity, because that's as close to God as you can possibly get. So that is the true concept of being kadosh, means to be devoted to the same purpose to which God devoted Himself when He created the world. So if God created the world to be good to others, and therefore our greatest good is to be good to others as well. If God created the world in a way in which one's he said in the manner which he describes as kiamati olam chesed ibonas, right, kindness, so we should be kind, and that's how we emulate God. So emulating God is the highest form of kedusha, and that refers specifically to doing things to benefit mankind. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to go out to Africa and teach illiterate natives how to read. Maybe we should be doing that too, right? But what it also can mean that you learn Torah, you sit in Beis Medrash and learn, but you don't do it just because you want to become a great Talmud Chacham, or because it's going to get you Olam Haba, because that's not really Kedusha. Kedusha is, I'm learning Torah because I want to generate more merit or more sanctity, or clear more, space, holy space, carve out more holy space in the world. So, in this sense, I've just used the word holiness. It's a borrowed term, because it's a holy or kadosh is also used in order to describe something which is holy, as opposed to being holy. So, there are places which are holy. The way Hasidim always divided. There are places which are called Olam, which are holy. There's Shana, there is the year, meaning times which are holy. And there is Nefesh, the souls who are holy. The souls who are holy are the ones which are devoted to the betterment of their fellow man. Then the reflection of that holiness of man can be found in holiness of places and holiness of times, and I should add also, obviously, holiness of objects. Now, when it refers to objects, obviously, the concept of doing good is meaningless when it comes to an object. You can do so because doing good with an object, but an object can't do good. So if an object is kodesh, it just means that it is set apart, sanctified to a specific purpose. And by the way, this is rarity. We have more words in English to describe the different forms of kedusha than we do in Hebrew. Because in English we have sanctified, consecrated, you know, made holy. In Hebrew it's all on the word kedusha. It all falls on the same word.
How about words? Are words holy? I mean, we can't say Hashem's name in full because there's a certain kedusha to it.
Right.
Of
course words are holy.
Right. Words are holy.
Yeah.
It's set apart for a certain purpose.
Yeah. The words.
Yeah, but okay, so my pen's holy because I'm only going to write with it in this year. Is that kedusha to it? That's
yeah.
Kedusha to it.
But that doesn't give it halacha to kedusha.
Right. So, I mean, it's my own created kedusha.
Right. But it's true. It makes sense what you're saying.
Okay.
That makes the pen a holier pen. Is it something which is quantifiable? No, it's very hard. You can't quantify it. You can really only quantify these things in human beings. Because you can tell when one human being is, not always, of course, but you can tell when one human being is holier than the other. If you're a particularly sensitive person, then you can tell that Yerushalayim is more holy than the rest of the world. Not everybody can do that, perhaps not even most people. If you're a really holy person, then you can tell that this object is more or less holy. Very few people can do that, right? Time, most people also can recognize as being holy, but I'm not sure if that's because we experience the time as that, or we fill the time with events which indicate that holiness. I don't know what's the cause and what's the effect. But the idea of objects is a very famous Gemara about Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair's donkey. Who remembers the story about Pinchas Ben Yair's donkey? Anybody?
Yeah. Well, I just remember what it does.
Non-tithe, ma'atevah. So his donkey was stolen, and the thieves wanted to feed the animal. So they gave the animal grain, which was not, ma'aser wasn't taken off of it. No ma'aser, no tithes were taken off it, so the animal refused to eat. And they were going crazy. They didn't know what was going on here, so they finally returned the animal to its owner. So Pinchas Ben Yair says, it wasn't worth it for them. So, right, Pinchas Ben Yair said, what can I do for this poor animal that she's machmir on herself? Now, what does it mean she's machmir on herself? Animals are not required to be machmir, not chai the mitzvahs. They're allowed to eat tevel, stuff which is not tight. But, Pinchas Ben Yair could distinguish what's holy or not. His donkey, which was made holy by association with him, also got a holiness monitor to see what's holy and what's not holy. So, since we're morons, none of this applies to us. But were we not morons, then some of it would apply to us. Are you any happier now?
Yeah, I mean, I remember, it's 6 month wave. I mean, I heard, part of this answer 6 months ago, and it, goes away, and then it comes back up.
The Gemara says in the end of the four, I think the fourth parak in Sukkah, it says Torah Lishma is Torah Shel Chesed. So if it's not Torah Chesed, it's not Torah Lishma. So what's Chesed? It can mean you're teaching other people, it can mean you're learning with other people, but it also can mean that when you learn, you learn for the benefit and merit of other people.
And so again, the learning of Gemara has an inherent kedusha to it because Hashem said, "Learn Gemara." Is that what gives Gemara its kedusha? What gives it its designation? Besides that, we create in the yeshiva system that it is very important to learn it, and that has been kedusha to it. I mean, what makes Gemara have its kedusha?
Parash Baal Peh. It contains the wisdom of God, which is transmitted orally from generation to generation. We call that holy for want of a better thin name. If you want to call it, you know...
But isn't the wisdom of God looking outside and looking at the way...
It's another form of kedusha.
Okay. So that's what I'm saying. Can we start to rank levels of kedusha?
Yeah, sure you can.
Okay. so...
You want to go ahead.
What to say you can't learn? I mean, what to say you can't learn? You have the same amount of Kedushin, can't learn. You looked at it as a complete coup. You were to say, well, my base measure is I'm going to go out into the forest. Not a knocking guy, but yeah, look at the different systems and the way things work and the way, you know, animals relate to their environment and the way a tree grows and take wisdom from the Bria. And take that. I mean, if you were to say to your Rosh Hashiva, this is my course of study, or part of my course of study for this semester, or for the Zman, crazy.
So there's the official answer and the unofficial answer. Which one do you want first?
Unofficial. First.
The official answer is Torah is a more effective and concentrated way of achieving that wondrous, you know, knowledge.
Okay.
Okay. You get that?
You can go out and look
at the trees and photosynthesis and appreciate God, but Torah is a much better way.
But to me, right, well, that's tough. I mean, if I go to Yellowstone National Park, I'm blown away. I mean, that to me is a very holy moment. Because it's like, I see it like straight.
Okay, so now can we go to the unofficial answer?
Okay.
The unofficial answer actually is two parts to it. One is that we're afraid of doing things outside the Beis Medrash, because who knows where it's going to lead. First you're going to go to trees, and then you're going to go to the Madison Square Garden and watch boxing, because it's in the wonders of God, right? The wrestling rabbi, right? So it's the slippery slope argument. But besides that, there is the other part of the unofficial answer, is that there's societal norms. Anybody who bucks norms is a weirdo. Mm. Should it be that way? No. But that's the way society is developed. Like, I'm regarded as a weirdo because I learn Yerushalmi.
Weirdo?
What? No, that's not the only reason. But that's one of them. Right? Because we don't learn Yerushalmi, right? Knowledge for us is a limited amount of knowledge.
Why are people putting Yerushalmi on
money? Because they have money they have to spend.
You just mean.
You're not a non-profit.
I don't know, I'm a
non-profit. So the foundation, they raise money. They have to, and besides, they want to keep people employed. But you're right, they don't expect many people to learn it.
There's so many things they can put out, like a school tomorrow, so many people actually learn it. And why? That's how they publish everything.
I think Shulchan Aruch
is the
idea of Yerushalmi is to be the same, is that if you're not able to read in Hebrew, then you're not worthy of reading yourself. So if you want to learn Shulchan Aruch, then you better know Hebrew. Otherwise, just ask a rabbi. Don't bother learning, because a little bit of learning is a dangerous thing. I think that's the assumption. But who knows? Maybe it's the only way the world will Shulchan Aruch.
Why Shulchan Aruch
is
in the
No, he meant one of those.
Oh, does that exist in English?
What?
Mishnevura exists in English.
Because Mishnevura is more of a popularization, as certainly the Kitzur is. But, you know, to do the actual, all the commentaries inside, that would be
going too far. What is it?
It would be giving access to ignoramuses to very, very great knowledge. And the Torah says, the Navi says, that like a golden ring in the nose of a pig is knowledge in the hands of a fool.
Like the Satu.
What about it?
Well, the sign on the bulletin board says that it's a sad day because it puts...
Yesterday, no, eighth of Tavis.
Because it's a two can put Torah knowledge in the hands of it says something eloquent.
Are we leading into a question here? I'm gonna
No.
He said why can't that be looked at the flip side, that why maybe the negative, because you're catering to the nations and having to explain yourself and dumbing down Torah, why can't it be looked at as trying to bring the Torah as a light unto the nation? Someone brought that point to me, and I'm asking you that.
Why
can't translating the Torah be looked at as a way to bring the light of Torah unto the nation?
It can. Why can't? Who said it can?
Why is it such a sad bit?
Because that translation was a coerced translation, which was not necessarily written according to specifications, which the rabbis would have wanted, ideally, to have in a translation. You know, many of you know, I'm sure, Arthur got into trouble publishing their Shir HaShirim.
Huh?
Nobody knows that yet?
It sounds pretty easy going, the
Shir HaShirim. There's a big disclaimer in front of it. The Shir HaShirim is a romantic love song, right? If you translate literally. So Artsko put out a translation which completely figures it, without any relation to the literal text. The princess, instead of talking about the princess, they use the Jewish people. Instead of talking about the groom, the king, they talked about God. They didn't translate it. And the simple level, and the king loved the maiden.
Right.
They translate it as, and God loved the Jews. What?
I'm
not criticizing art. I'm saying the opposite.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying that a translation which has to be literal is much more of a problem.
Who did they get in trouble with?
The Imam Orthodox.
Right.
Yeah.
You gotta choose between the Fermis and the dangerous modern.
No, they want to be able to sell books to whoever they can.
Non-profit.
There's two parts of our story. There's non-profit and the profit.
Alright. How much money did they lose?
I don't know.
Putting it that way.
Not that. No, probably not that much.
Okay.
But,
probably
would have lost more the other way. It's like they alienated all the Fermi. Could be.
Right.
You know, to hear the one about the Jewish Orthodox feminists. You know the Jewish Orthodox feminist organization called Jofa.
Based in Manhattan.
Anything nutty is based in Manhattan. So the.
That's a great quote.
So the. Well, that's why I teach in Manhattan, obviously. So they came out and they complained. Art School just put out a Twitter for women, right? Twitter for women specifically. And they came out, killed Jofa, and complained because the Art School Twitter said women are not necessarily required to daven three times or even two times a day. And they went ballistic because that indicates that women are of inferior status to men. So they're actually trying to say that Arthur should be machmir on women because that would be more egalitarian. So if you want to criticize something, you'll find a way to criticize it,
right,
even if it makes life easier for you.
We were talking about those
Jofa?
Yeah.
I don't know. Look at their website, jofa.org.
We were talking about those before. And one thing I have a question about, so what about all these other extraneous books that are like selling at Lishkas? Ones that are not necessarily Halakha or Mishnah or Gemara.
They're
inspiring. They're inspiring, but what are they? They're not holy, right?
They contain Sukkot. They contain Gemara and Torah thoughts.
But besides that, they're extraneous words. I mean,
they're right. But the fact that they contain Sukkot in and of itself, that's something. They approximate Torah. You're right. If they say stupid things, then that's not Torah. But they do, yeah, they have to supplement them, Gemaras, and they approximate Torah, so... Anyway, the fact that Lishka sells them just means they can make money off of it. Right? So that doesn't prove anything either way. Anyway, I want to say one more thing tonight about the Shulchan Aruch before we break, which is that the Shulchan Aruch, Koshim Mishpat, there's a special halacha, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but I did stop me. There's a special halacha in Judaism called Kimli. Kimli means, what? No, that's Kumle, literally. Kimli means, if you come and you sue me, and you have very strong evidence. And most poskim hold that you should win this case. But one poskim hold you don't, that, like me, which gives me the advantage, I can say, Kimli, I hold like that one poskim. You can't do it in Arachayim, you can't do it in Yerodei, you can't do it in Eben Ezra, you can do it in Choshim Mishpat. Why is that? Because the principle is in monetary law, Hamotzi Mechaver Lov Araya. You want to take out money from this guy? Prove that you are right. Beyond a reasonable doubt. And as long as he has one posek on his side, he can say, well, I don't like that posek. Right? So what right do you have the money to take money away from me if I hold like him? So Rav Yonis and Eibshitz, who is going to be a major topic of conversation in a few weeks, to a great 18th century Rav, he says, you can't say Kimli on an opinion which is rejected by the Shulchan Aruch. He says, the limit. You can say Kimli if something is not discussed in Shulchan Aruch, or if that opinion is brought up in Shulchan Aruch in some way, shape, or form. But opinion is not brought up in Shulchan Aruch and thus rejected, so you can't say Kimli like that. Because once the Shulchan Aruch was written, that became the benchmark. Everything which is compatible to Shulchan Aruch is legitimate. Everything which is not compatible is no longer considered to be a legitimate halachic perspective. The reason he gives that is because he says it's clear to him that the Beis Yosef and Ramah wrote with Ruach HaKodesh. Because they have such profound things that they must for sure have had Ruach HaKodesh, and therefore, whatever they decided to include or not include, they were guided by the hand of God. So that's why we can only say Kimli if an opinion appears in Shulchan Aruch, not if it's beyond the pale. Now, Shulchan Aruch is defined as the top part of the page. Now, the top part of the page meaning Shulchan Aruch with the early commentaries. Where exactly the line is over here, over here, over here, not sure exactly for now. But in any event, the Shulchan Aruch means this, and whatever doesn't appear there is not a valid claim for you to take. Because the Shulchan Aruch is such a benchmark and cutting off air at the time. Okay, I'll stop here for this evening. I'll be back tomorrow night.